I sent my talk to somebody in this room who will remain nameless, and I said, I'm coming to see this talk on transgender rights. I presume the law is the same in Northern Ireland. My rewrite last night was pretty pretty rapid. So the handout you have is basically what we're going to go through. You will have to spot the differences as we go through the slides, and you can write. So that will keep you awake as we go into this particular situation. The other thing I want to do is highlight to you, Peter has done, the CMF files on these things. I did one on hard cases and the law, which looks more at assisted suicide. But as we'll see, sometimes the law is reactive rather than proactive. Sometimes we react to circumstances. And maybe you'll see that as we go through the law on this particular area. Are these hard cases that needs to be thought through in terms of the law? The gender dysphoria one is fantastic, so please do look at that one. And how we react this with Christian doctors in a post-Christian society. How do we think through some of these issues? So that's CMF files 59, 57, and 54. I have the real privilege of being part of the group that looks at these files and how it's developed, and it's a really good quality group of people, and what Peter does in that group is fantastic. So there's a huge amount of hard work put into that. So we're going to be looking at the law a little bit, and I spoke earlier on about the fact that times change, and I gave you an example in my own practice where time has definitely changed the way that we view the law. 45 years ago, in a family divorce case called Corbett in 1971, April Ashley, who was born male and has underwent hormonal treatment and sex reassignment to become a female, and then married a male. Justice Ormerod granted a decree of nullity to the husband in that particular case on the ground that the respondent, that is the person who'd had the gender reassignment, is not and was not a woman at the date of the ceremony of marriage, but was at all times male. Now, according to the judge in that case, the issue before him was the true sex of April Ashley, and it was secondary whether she had the capacity to consummate the marriage. And he said, having regard to the essentially heterosexual character of the relationship, which is called marriage, the criteria must, in my judgment, be biological. For even the most extreme degree of transsexualism in a male, or the most severe hormonal imbalance which can exist in a person with male chromosomes, male gonads, and male genitalia, cannot produce a person who is naturally capable of performing the essential role of a woman in a marriage. Now, given what Peter's just sort of said, we've seen a sea change in the way in which judges would now approach this. In that particular case, there was recognition of transsexualism as a psychiatric disorder, which has been accompanied by the development of sophisticated techniques of medical treatment. We have to roll on 25 years to 1996, when there was a significant change as a result of this particular case. P was an employee at an educational establishment operated by Cornwall County Council, and was hired as a male employee. He later informed the council that he wanted to have gender reassignment because he was planning to undergo an operation for gender change. After the surgery, the applicant was not permitted to return from sick leave in her new female gender role. The applicant then, of course, went to court and complained that she had been discriminated against on grounds of sex in violation of the principle of equal treatment for men and women as regards to access for employment and vocational training. Now, the European Court of Justice ruled in that particular case, which led to this sea change, that there had been a violation of the principle of equal treatment in relation to work. And that led to a number of changes, both in the England and Wales context and in the Northern Irish context. And so there was an amendment to the Sex Discrimination Act in England and Wales, and in Northern Ireland, the Sex Discrimination Regulations in 1999 came about. And I have those if you'd like to read them. They're some of the most complicated things I've had to read, I have to say, over the last 24 hours. This was the first case law anywhere in the world, this particular case, which prevented discrimination in employment or vocational education by a person being transsexual. So what is the definition of gender reassignment? Gender reassignment means a process which is undertaken under medical supervision for the purpose of reassigning a person's sex by changing psychological or other characteristics of sex, and includes any part of such process, which that's stated in the Sex Discrimination Regulations 1999. Now, I understand the Equality Act 2010 doesn't apply here, hence my rewrite. But under England Wales law, it's where a person is proposing to undergo, is undergoing or has undergone a process or part of a process for the purpose of reassigning the person's sex by changing psychological or other attributes of sex. So in those circumstances, the question remains, is this a social construct or is it a medical biological definition? Further developments then took place because of this particular case. In 2002, the European Court of Human Rights, sitting in the Grand Chamber, effectively overruled that earlier judgment of Cobbett in this particular case of Christine Goodwin. The applicant to the ECHR was born male, had undergone hormone therapy, vocal cord therapy, and gender reassignment surgery. She alleged that in refusing to change her social security card, national insurance card, and birth certificates to reflect her new female sex, the state had violated her right to respect for private life under Article 8 of the Convention. Not only that, but under Article 12, of course, there was a violation of her right to marry her partner. And there's the Article 12 is the right to family life. And the court in that case agreed, noting that the applicant had experienced stress and alienation that resulted from the discordance between her identity and the lack of her legal recognition. So there was a conflict, as it were, between the social reality of her situation and that of the law. And that was what they said was a serious interference with private life. A serious interference with private life can arise where the state of domestic law conflicts with an important aspect of personal identity. So in that case, the European Court of Human Rights rejected the Corbett assertion that sex was determined at birth and on the basis of chromosomal and other factors. It found that the chromosomal element should not take on a decisive significance for the purposes of legal attribution of gender identity. A huge shift took place, and it departed from that law. And of course, this was in Europe, and that led to this particular case, Bellinger. In the UK, only a year before, 2001, it had been the whole situation had been looked at. And in Bellinger, they had appealed a lower court's decision, and that decision, Bellinger was asking for a declaration that she was female at the time of her marriage and that she was validly married. So she was. It was a direct attack on Corbett. Now, Bellinger was male at birth and had married a woman and divorced in 1971, ironically. The petitioner then underwent gender reassignment surgery. In 1981, she went through a ceremony of marriage with a male who was aware of the background and supported her by living as husband and wife. Now, on the marriage certificate, she was described as a spinster and wasn't asked for any further information about her gender status by the marriage registrar. And that Bellinger then had to go to court, and she said the Court of Appeal in 2001 stated that determining sex was based on biological factors. And despite the increasing recognitions of transsexual rights, the UK authorities remained unchanged. They couldn't derive a right in 2001 from Article 12 to marry a person of the biological sex opposite to that which was attributed to at birth. So the right to marry was restricted, as with Corbett, to between people of opposite biological sex. And of course, only a year later, Goodwin then happened at the European Court of Human Rights, and Bellinger went back to the House of Lords. So they'd been to the Court of Appeal. The Court of Appeal had said no. The status quo is there. We know what it is here in the UK, despite what Europe said. So it went to the House of Lords. Now, the House of Lords, it criticised the Corbett decision, but it held that to overturn would necessitate giving the expressions male and female in the matrimonial legislation, and these are the House of Lords' words, a novel and extended meaning. But it granted a declaration of incompatibility with the Human Rights Act. And the important thing was that the House of Lords then said, the question of gender recognition and the recognition of gender assignment for the purposes of marriage was not a matter for the courts, it was a matter for Parliament. Because the courts recognised that to decide upon this was to decide on a far-reaching and sensitive socio-political issue. And here we have, therefore, the Gender Recognition Act. The position had been highlighted, and that meant that Parliament had to do something. So that's why we now have the Gender Recognition Act 2004. And it created a process, as Peter had said, to enable a transsexual to get their UK birth certificates and legal gender changed by applying to the government's gender recognition panel. And again, as Peter had said, you need to be 18, you need to have lived fully for 2 years in the acquired gender with the intention to live permanently in that acquired gender for the rest of your life. And you need the two medical reports, one from a GP and one from a gender specialist, confirming the gender dysphoria diagnosis and detailing any potential treatment. Now, it's not necessary for the person to have undergone the surgery, but the medical reports have to give the reasons why that has not taken place. It's an administrative process in law, and if successful, you then take on the rights and responsibilities appropriate to the person of the acquired gender. And of course, that has profound consequences. In terms of everything, how does it work in terms of sporting competitions? How does all these sort of things go? Suddenly, everyone's like, "Oh my word, we need some regulations around this. How do we deal with this?" Now, that leads on to what you have here, which is a sex discrimination gender reassignment regulations Northern Ireland 1999, which again you can go and read if you wish to do so. And it's important because there are protective characteristics. Now, we talk about protective characteristics. I'll slip into that. That's because it's the Equality Act that we have in the UK. But here, those characteristics are sex, including gender reassignment and pregnancy and maternity, disability, race, religious belief, and political opinion or sexual orientation. And of course, it's prohibited for there to be direct discrimination in relation to each of these particular areas, to treat somebody less favourably as a result of their having ongoing or undergone gender reassignment. So if there is a policy at work that prevents transgender people from being able to work and live in their new gender, then that's unlawful. It's discriminatory. So if somebody goes in and informs their employer that they intend to spend the rest of their life living as a different gender, and say the employer then transfers them into a different role, which means they don't have face-to-face contact with somebody, then that's discriminatory, and that is wrong in the eyes of the law. You cannot discriminate in those circumstances. And then, of course, there's indirect discrimination, which is a practice or a policy or a rule which applies to everybody, but some people are worse off as a result of that. You put somebody at a disadvantage. Now, sometimes that's okay if it's objectively justifiable. There's a legitimate aim in that indirect discrimination. We're going to talk about harassment in a minute, but victimisation is also discriminatory, and that's discriminatory here in Northern Ireland under the Disability Discrimination Act, the Fair Employment and Treatment Northern Ireland Order, the Race Relations Northern Ireland Order, and the Sex Discrimination Northern Ireland Order as well. So to treat somebody badly because they have done a protected act, such as making a claim, or helping somebody to make a claim, is victimisation. So, for example, if a tutor mistreats a student because he thinks that that person is going to intends to support another student's claim on transgender, then that, of course, is victimisation. You're picking on somebody because of that situation. Harassment does apply here in Northern Ireland. Harassment is unwanted conduct that is related to those protected characteristics, and it violates dignity and creates a working environment that's intimidating, hostile, degrading, humiliating, and offensive. None of us would want to see anybody be put through any of those particular things. It seeks to protect people from being harassed. and employers and service providers are justified in limiting that unwelcome behaviour, stamping out in a working environment something that is actively hostile towards somebody because of their transgenderism. And when deciding whether it is whether something is harassment, we take into account the perception of the person who's being harassed and the other circumstances of the case, and whether it's reasonable for the conduct to have that effect. There is, however, what's known here as the genuine occupational qualification defence, GORs in England and Wales, genuine occupational requirements, but this is genuine occupational qualification. In the UK does not contravene the Act by applying in relation to work a protected characteristic on this basis. If being a man is a genuine occupational qualification, or being a woman is a genuine occupational qualification for the job. But the employer, and that's important, the employer must show that the treatment is reasonable with view to this. So I noticed as I was doing some research that Women's Aid here in Northern Ireland had a post advertised. It's open to women only. And for this post, being a woman is a genuine occupational requirement. So in those circumstances, you have to have a genuine occupational requirement. I'm just making sure that the lawyers here are sort of looking at me and not didn't dis- but that's the way that we look at it in these circumstances. You have to have a genuine occupational requirement. And that's something that we need to understand for churches too. And I'll go on to the religious exemptions in a minute. There are other exemptions too. The job needs to be held by a man to preserve decency or privacy because, and that you can put woman in there as well, is likely to involve physical contact with men in circumstances where they might reasonably object to it being carried out by a woman or vice versa, and the holder of the job is likely to do his work in circumstances where men might reasonably object to the presence of that. This came up in a major case in relation to the police and searching requirements. A post-operative male-to-female transsexual, her application to join the police force as a woman was rejected by the police force on the ground that she could not perform a full searching duties required of a constable. The chief constable maintained that it was a genuine occupational qualification with its meaning for a constable to be capable of searching men and women, and P could search neither, given that under domestic law she was a man. So on all intents and purposes she's a woman. So it was one of those situations of decency. In the employment tribunal, it was upheld, but P went to court, the Court of Appeal, who ruled in favour, and the House of Lords agreed, saying that no one of that gender searched by a person could reasonably object to the search. So it's another sea change in looking at these particular areas. The difference in treatment may be lawful in these particular circumstances. Ministers of religion may refuse to marry persons whose acquired gender has been recognised under the 2004 Act. And this is an important one in terms of Regulation 5, in the fact that displaying the provisions of the order in relation to discrimination under Article 4A, if the limitations imposed to comply with the doctrines of a religion or to avoid offending the religious susceptibilities of a significant number of the religion's followers. So you can apply an exemption in that particular situation. So that sort of looks in many respects, and I was going to go into goods and services, but it's quite complicated here. It doesn't apply to goods and services. And so therefore, it's really in relation to employment and vocational training that much of this comes up. But here's the current scene. We've heard a lot from Peter about the whole idea of gender reassignment as a social construct, as against biological. And it does have a huge focus on healthcare and the healthcare sector. But this is an issue that we as Christians need to grapple with. Are we able to offer genuine support to those who are suffering discrimination as a result of their gender assignment? All those we see need to understand that they should be given and need to be given genuine love and care from us without ignoring the truth of the gospel. Those who are transgender are made in the image of God and they're deeply loved by him. And if we cannot be compassionate, then we need to examine our own motives and our own selves. We have all fallen short. And from that perspective, we should be offering that love. And I would recommend highly Vaughan Roberts' book. There's one of them is out on the bookstall, and he says you need to understand the terms that are being used. We need to understand this and be passing it on within our churches. You are the people who should be speaking into these situations within your churches and enabling people to understand this, because people will be coming. We have somebody in my own church who is going through various different issues, and sometimes turns up as a woman, sometimes turns up a man, and we have to deal with that. And Bourne gives another example of another church that he's been to. So how are we dealing with that? And so we have all of these things that are going on that we need to be understanding, and also what is happening in terms of others and what they're saying. I was going to move on to these of science and faith, the rights of patients, bullying, harassment, rights of treatment, and we'll finish up with the showers and toilets. Somebody's sex is determined by his chromosomes. Being transgender, I think, is mainly a mental condition. This was quoted in Unhealthy Attitudes. This is what others are saying. How are we able, as Peter has been quite clearly explained to us, how are we able to speak into all of this? Current GMC guidance permits a doctor not to provide or refer any patients proposing to undergo gender assignment for particular services to which he or she may. And we've heard that already from Peter. I was interested to read this, the Stonewall and their Memorandum of Understanding, which was created in 2015 on the so-called gay cures, where those who signed up to it agreed that it was not only impossible to change someone's sexual orientation, it was also unethical and potentially harmful. And then a new memorandum is being created that includes gender identity into this, with an additional message that trying to change people's somebody's gender identity through a therapy is impossible, unethical, and potentially harmful. With a follow-up statement saying, conversion therapy is the term for therapy that assumes certain sexual orientations or gender identities are inferior to others and seeks to change or suppress them on that basis, and that sexual orientations and gender identities are not mental disorders, although exclusion, stigma, and prejudice may precipitate mental health issues for any person subjected to these abuses. Anyone accessing therapeutic help should be able to do so without fear of judgment on the threat or the threat of being pressured to change a fundamental aspect of who they are. And Peter was putting out to us, how are we going to be dealing with this, and who is making the agenda in terms of whether this is seen as something where people are genuinely dealing with it as a mental health issue, or whether it's dealing with an identity issue. And the signatory organisations to this statement, the UK Council for Psychotherapy, the British Association for Counselling and Psychotherapy, the British Psychological Society, the College of Sexual and Relational Therapists, LGBT Doctors and Dentists, the National Counselling Society, NHS Scotland, Pink Therapy, Royal College of General Practitioners, Scottish Government, and Stonewall. There's a shadow here. How are Christians and how will Christians be able to act according to conscience in these particular areas going forward? We talked about conscience earlier on. How are people going to be dealing with that who have a conscience issue? Of course, there are conflicting rights that we are going to have to be dealing with. Female or male patient in hospital who does not wish to be treated by a transgender nurse or doctor. Does the hospital discriminate as an employer discriminate by acceding to this request? Can a GP's surgery refuse to employ a transgender partner? These are sensitivities. We need to deal with these sensitivities. Of course, the prescribing of treatment is another area of conflict and conscience. Are we affirming a lifestyle? Are we at what point? And Peter gave the various different levels as to how far you would go in healthcare and provision as until such time as you refer on. There are limitations. The genuine occupational requirement defence or the genuine occupational qualification defence does not apply to detriment claims. We have a sort of situation here where if you're offering and dismissal does provide some exemptions, but if they're employed by you, you cannot treat people differently. You can't say we're not offering you promotion just because they're transsexual. How do we deal with this? We need to deal with it sensitively. How do we look at it in terms of at what stage? We need to understand the effects of the Gender Recognition Act. We looked earlier on about the chief constable in Yorkshire. There's a lot more that could be said in relation to the right to private and family life and the protection of religion and belief. I just want to move on because time is moving us on to bullying and harassment of staff by fellow staff. These are Stonewall findings. 10% of health and social care staff say they are aware of colleagues experiencing discrimination or poor treatment because they are trans. 7% of health and social care staff said they would not feel comfortable working alongside a trans colleague. Employers and service providers are justified in limiting, as I said before, unwelcome behaviour. We want to show the world that as Christians, we are compassionate and loving, and that people should not feel harassed. They should not feel victimised, and we should not actively shun a colleague because of who they are in their transgenderism. We need to understand how we bring a biblical worldview into that situation too. There's 11% have witnessed negative remarks about people who are trans in the last year. A transgender nurse is often referred to as a he, she, or it by service users alike. Some service users have complained about being cared for by this nurse based on her being trans and not based on the quality of care. These are important things for us to be thinking through. In this particular area, failing to take sufficient steps to prevent a racial harassment by a third party was a breach of the Race Discrimination Directive. And now in these circumstances, an employer can be legally responsible for failing to take action in specific circumstances in relation to trans. These would arise where the employer has some degree of control over a situation where there is a continuing course of offensive conduct of which they're aware but do not take action. Something that we need to be understanding and taking a stand on. Times where we've looked after transgender people, they have never been asked where they would prefer to be looked after, whether they would feel more comfortable in a male bay, female bay, or a side room. Again, this is something that a hospital can be held vicariously liable for harassment of staff or service users. What about if hospitals or insurance companies treat transgender patients in an indirectly discriminatory way for not providing or prioritising their health needs? There was a particular case, Schlumpfen, I should say Switzerland, there should be a T in there. Case concerned the refusal of Max Schlumpf's health insurers to pay the cost of his sex change operation on the ground that he had not complied with a 2-year period before gender reassignment surgery, as required by the case law. And the court held that there had been a violation of Article 8, the right to a family life, by applying that waiting period mechanically and without having regard to that particular trans age, which was 67. The applicant was 67 at the time. So in those circumstances, the delay was seen to be unlawful. Although it's probably not unlawful in the circumstances where a particular service treats everybody the same, which is the Chowdhury case. But these are areas which are now starting to develop. And then finally, there's this particular case of Croft Hill. The case involves the use of female toilets by a male-to-female preoperative transsexual. And in Miss Croft's case, the court said that circumstances dictated for a period of time Miss Croft should not be entitled to use the female toilet, and that the unisex disabled toilet was sufficient for her to use. And the time in that particular case had not yet come when she was entitled to use the female toilet facilities. But this is important. The Court of Appeal said that merely being a preoperative male to female transsexual would not in itself entitle a person to use a female toilet. On the other hand, permanently refusing someone the use of female toilets, even though they have not undergone the final operation, could amount to discrimination. So we're now in a situation where that's something an employer must consider. And it must consider all circumstances in each individual case to make a judgment as to whether a pre-operative male to female transsexual can still use a female toilet. Employers should have regard to their other employees, the circumstances of the transsexual person, and at what stage they've reached their medical treatment. However, the employer is not at this time bound by the transsexual's own self-determination or self-definition. but it is one of the considerations that needs to be taken into account. These are areas of law which, to be honest, are moving so quickly and so fast that we've just got to keep our heads above the parapet to understand what's coming and understanding that. And you've already talked here about the fact that you're living in a particular circumstance here in this place, and you need to understand these things are going to come up. You're going to have to be dealing with them and talking to people in your workplaces and in your churches about these particular issues. It's 2:15. I will stop. Thank you ever so much for listening to the Law Lecture.